for those who know every line, and for those finding Star Wars for the very first time, welcome to Growing Up Skywalker.
Welcome to Growing Up Skywalker. My name is Anna.
And I'm Sam.
This week, we are moving into like the belly of Andor. We're covering season one, episode seven, Announcement.
Announcements, announcements, announcements.
Not as fun as in school. Did I finish that note correctly? I feel like I'm probably actually tone deaf.
I'm not going to answer that question.
Okay, that's political of you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Before we move into the episode proper, would you like to talk a little bit about the ongoing strike in our world?
Sure would. SAG-AFTRA is still striking. The strike counter just hit 100 days.
Yesterday.
And we are standing in deep solidarity with striking actors and members of SAG-AFTRA. It's really important for a lot of different reasons to make sure that they're getting paid, not only because they have a union insurance program, and as long as they get paid enough, they actually get health insurance, but also that, like, this is how one can make a living as an actor. And SAG-AFTRA is fighting for that. They know that they need more actors because it makes the world a wonderful place. So we stand in solidarity with them. And we ask that you skip the watch through this week. And, you know, tone down your streaming. Let's support your actors, local or otherwise. Moving right along into the episode.
So in this episode, we do our customary plot musical chairs. We actually open this one on the S plot for Cyril Karn, who we have not seen in over an episode. And I gotta say, I kind of missed him.
Oh my gosh, his life is so terrible.
Mom is the worst. I relate to her so much. I just feel like if I was in Star Wars, maybe I would be Edie Karn.
Wow.
Yeah. Isn't that alarming?
Just waking up and hitting these bombs on me is ridiculous.
Waking up dropping truth bombs on my fiance. I feel like I'm Edie Karn.
Wow. Out of all the characters in Star Wars.
I know. I'm likewise disappointed. Anyway, Edie wakes up her adult son on the day of his terrible interview. Uncle Harlow came through with the family favor. Cyril has an interview with the Bureau of Standards, which sounds just as awful to you as it probably does to him.
If you imagine how dehumanizing, like, a office space or Dilbert-esque cubicle farm is, and then put it in space where you're sitting in a recliner and you don't have screens. You just have like these things in front of you and a tiny little screen the size of a phone screen that's 10 feet away.
You don't even have like a partition wall. Everyone can see you all the time.
And it's like super spacey, but it's also like, are you supposed to like sit in here all day? Does that have like a attached toilet or what is this? This is deeply dehumanizing.
It's almost as bad as in Rebels when our Rodian friend had the data lock on his neck.
Oh, that's true.
So it's actually not that bad. Okay. I guess humans get better treatment in Andor than aliens. Anyway, while Karn is eating his space loops before his interview, he's watching the news. And the Aldani heist has reached newscasts as far as Coruscant. And that's where we pick up on the I plot for Imperial, also ISB. In the I plot, the Empire is responding to the Aldani heist by closing its fist.
The big boss rolls in, and you probably don't recognize him, but you would if you knew his name. That is Admiral Yularen.
What?
Yeah, Admiral Yularen
of the Republic?
Is the head of the ISB.
And I'm sorry. Am I? What?
Yeah.
When did that happen?
Sometime in the intervening 15 years.
Why did that happen?
Because he's a loyal officer of the Empire.
Wait, but he's bad.
Yularen?
He was the one giving the speech about the Empire responding back in force, right?
Yes.
This is why we prepare in times of peace. This is why we demand so much.
Yes.
What?
Yeah.
Was he brainwashed?
More to follow, but Admiral Ularen, leading the ISB, is sitting there over Major Partagaz's planning meeting and expositing what's happening, which is that everything is being locked down, taxes are being levied. Anyone who wears the wrong clothing on the wrong day will be accused of anti-imperial sentiment. And importantly, all crimes are being reevaluated. All sentences are being multiplied by 10 and problems will ensue.
I'm glad you did that plot recap because I feel like I'm hallucinating. Okay. Anyway, yeah. So the point is that anything galaxy-wide that even smells like it could be anti-imperial is just an immediate felony. So go die.
Yeah.
Deirdre Miro is the one in the room who doesn't seem excited about this. She's worried that the Empire is playing right in the rebels' hands by reacting so harshly. So she goes ahead and she uses this emergency situation to order a galactic sweep of basically anything across any star system that seems like it could have been stolen by the rebels. And she's piecing together where it might have been sent.
The poor reference librarian was sleeping on the job and she goes in and he's like, oh dear, that's a question. But because you caught me sleeping on the job, I'm going to have to do it. It's brutal.
I mean, everyone has been up all night. Mm-hmm. So, like, you can't blame him. It's just Deirdre Miro's on the freaking warpath. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately for all of us, minus Deirdre Miro and the ISB, she is so good at her job and she did such a good job piecing this data together that Major Partagaz basically promotes her and puts Ferrix in her portfolio to keep doing this full time.
So they're going around the room giving their staff reports, and Blevin is like, I wish to file a formal complaint against Deirdre Miro for investigating my stuff. And Deirdre says, the rebels are using our subsectors as boundaries. They're using them as fences so that they can use, like, jump from one to the other. They're using them as artificial constraints, knowing that we won't cross them. Ooh. And Partagaz is like, do you have evidence? And she's like, boy, howdy, check this out.
Color-coded, highlighted, paper-clipped in sections.
And also, I think that Blevin is aware of this report and is bringing it to your attention, trying to shield himself from blame. And Partagaz is like, fascinating. Walk with me, Deirdre.
Oh, it's so good. He's like, I wonder what my life would be like if all of you were as good at your job as Deirdre Miro. I guess we'll never know. She is one of the most competent Imperial agents we've ever seen, mm-hmm. and now she's got her sights set on Ferrix. Anyway, then we cut to the L plot for Luthen.
Good old Luthen.
Slash the M plot for Mothma. Good thing they're next to each other in the alphabet.
And they're, it's funny, in some of the scenes we're panning overhead on Coruscant, the ISB directorate office is like two space blocks away from Luthen's antiquities.
Whoa.
Yeah, when they zoom out, they like zoom out from his landing pad and pan over and then zoom in on ISB. They're right next to each other.
I hadn't noticed that. That's fantastic. The point is that Deirdre is 100% right. Mm-hmm. Luthen is thrilled that the Empire is overreacting to the Aldani heist. So Mon Mothma comes blowing into the art gallery. She's got her present from Perrin, mm-hmm. her present to Perrin that she promised to bring back, which gave me so much joy. Mm-hmm. And she's all upset about what Luthen did because she has some kind of meeting tonight to try to secure the funding that she promised for the rebellion. And she was too slow and Luthen overstepped her.
There's also the fact that she is worried about the consequences.
Yeah.
She said, I was building a network. And he says, well, it'll either grow or die. The network is in place and we need to use it. And she says, people will suffer. And he says, that's kind of the point.
He's like, people are already being choked. They need to realize how tight the noose is to yes. move forward.
Yes, exactly.
So Mon goes back to her house and throws a fabulous house party, mm-hmm. and she uses it to confide in one of her oldest friends, Tay Colma. He is a Rush Clovis-like banker man, except he's nicer than Rush Clovis. I shouldn't have drawn that parallel.
I mean, he seems nice.
He seems cool. He's a banker from Chandralan.
Which is Chandrila, which is Mon Mothma's planet that she represents.
And she wants to lean on his rebellion sympathies to get him to access her family fortune so she can use it to fund the rebellion.
They're dancing around the topic of politics. And he's like, I think you might find when you step away from, you know, the halls of power on Coruscant that I've become a little radical for your tastes. And she's like, everyone sees me as the thorn in the side who's a polite nuisance to the Empire. That is a front. I am setting up a organization for Chandrilan outreach. I need you to launder money for me.
And he's like, what for? And she's like, I'm not going to answer that question.
You don't want me to answer that. Which is such a baller move. And this whole time, it's such a fraught conversation because Perrin is like watching her. Leda's watching her. And she's talking to him. And she keeps saying, smile. Smile. We're having a conversation about our old school days. Life is wonderful. Keep smiling.
It is so great. My palms were sweaty watching it. It was amazing.
It's a great scene.
So once Mon lays the next stage in her plan, we pick up with, I guess I'll call this the R plot for Rebels.
Mm-hmm.
Cinta made it out of the garrison on Aldani. She is speeder scooting around the highlands. She's fine. Vel is on Coruscant, meeting up with some cool rebel lady.
That is Clea.
That's Clea? She looks like Scarlet Witch.
They do a costume swap. It's very funny. Vel, having been like wearing nothing but wool she harvested herself and felted into little like Icelandic caps, switches into like beautiful
full glam.
Got her hair done. Looks great and is sitting in Coruscant. Clea is like hood up, braids out, makeup off, just faceless,
unrecognizable. Mm-hmm. She looked like, I mean, it was like a Duchess Satine Little Red Riding Hood cape.
Yeah, it's cool.
God, I just didn't recognize anybody this episode. People could be dancing naked in front of me with tea cozies on their head, and I'd be like, I wonder who that is.
Well, that's obviously the point. And that's another Tot scene, because Clea is walking across Coruscant. She like walks a certain amount of steps, looks down, sees a chalk marking, takes a turn, is striding along, and is ignoring that there's stormtroopers everywhere, just walking perfectly normally.
And she tells Vel that there's a loose end. Cassian Andor needs to be eliminated so that he forgets all about Luthen.
Mm-hmm.
So now we've got Vel on Cassian's trail. Cassian has gone back to Ferrix.
Yep.
He goes straight to Marva. He dodges all of the stormtroopers. There's Imperials all over the streets. He's got all of his credits in hand. And he's like, look, Ma, I made it. I'm going to take you to your new retirement home. Mm-hmm. Let's get out of Ferrix. And Marva is super weird about it.
She's super weird about it. And they decide to think on it overnight. He's like, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize the time zone difference on different planets. It's way past your bedtime. We'll talk on it in the morning, but pack your stuff.
And then he goes to see Bix. And Bix is equally weird about everything, but at least she explains why. She tells Cassian that in the wake of the Mall Cop siege on Ferrix, everyone found out what he did. He killed the Mall Cops. He came home to hide. He got the imps set on their hometown. Mm-hmm. Everyone's mad at him. Anyone would turn him in for a dime.
Yeah.
And he needs to get out of here, basically.
He also learns that his betrayer was Spaced Him, and he's like, ugh, Spaced Him.
Good thing Spaced Him is now dead.
Yeah. And he's like, Bix, I'm sorry about Spaced Him. And she's like, it's not about Spaced Him.
Fair. It was never about Spaced Him.
It was never about Spaced Him.
Even when the plot revolved around Spaced Him, it was never really about Spaced Him. So Cassian leaves a pouch of coins. He leaves 12 grand in credits. And he's like, pay off my debts. You'll never see me again. He yeets himself back to Marva's house. And then he's like, okay, Marva, are you ready? And in one of the most beautiful scenes of the show so far, she tells him she's not going because the robbery at Aldani gave her hope. She's staying on Ferrix. She's joining the rebellion. And she will do anything that needs doing to overthrow the Empire.
She talks about how Clem, the Andor paterfamilias, had hung on Rick's Road. And we actually get that in a flashback sequence. Mm-hmm. We get to see what happened, which is that the troops, and they looked kind of like very early Imperial troops. They kind of had clone trooper armor a little bit. We're walking along, and then the locals were flinging rocks at them, and Clem runs into the crowd of rock throwers to try to stop them, and then the rock throwers all dissipate, and Clem is standing there with a bunch of stormtroopers pointing guns at him.
Wrong place, wrong time. He hangs in the square at the end of Rick's Road.
And Marva says, every day when I walk to the plaza, I take the long way around so I don't have to see the square where Clem was hanged. But today,
I put on my best clothes, I smiled, and I walked straight through the square. Because people were brave enough to storm an entire Imperial garrison. And if they can be brave enough to do that, I can be brave enough to stay here.
Yeah.
And do what needs to be done.
And then she says, Cassian, you can't stay and I can't go.
I'm tearing up just thinking about it. Oh my gosh.
It was amazing.
It was incredible. I can't wait to talk about it. The point is that Cassian leaves her. He tries to go somewhere that the Empire hasn't ruined yet, but the Empire is everywhere. So he ends up on this beach planet sleeping with this hot, terrible hookup gal.
There is like Saturday morning rave music playing the entire scene.
It's very Ibiza. It's very uncomfortable. Cassian's wearing these like foppish beach clothes. He's minding his own business. He's going to the store. And then he's literally arrested for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. This stormtrooper dude is looking to flex his authority. And Cassian's just trying to walk to the store. And this guy's like, you look sweaty. I'm taking you to the courthouse.
And he's like, it's hot. And it's like, yeah, well, you know, I'm just a tourist. He's like, tourists don't run. He's like, I wasn't running.
Oh, my gosh.
That stormtrooper, shore trooper, actually, is played by Sam Witwer.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
He was so good at being detestable. I'm no longer surprised.
Cassian ends up getting lifted by the throat by a KX unit droid, which is very scary, and comes to in court.
And then it turns out that in the wake of Cassian's crime on Aldani, the jail sentences for every possible crime have been maxed out and ratcheted up so hard that he's now getting a 6-year sentence for being a tourist.
Yep.
And that doesn't even seem as bad as the final shot of the episode, which is Cyril Karn in his new space cubicle filing error reports on fuel purity.
I literally have in all caps, Cyril Drome, oh God, the crushing oppression of labor.
Amazing.
So that's where we end it.
Sorry that was so long. There's just a lot going on in announcements.
Yeah, this is catching up with the setup and the heist, and now we have to deal with something. But Cassian's going to jail for 6 years.
Dude, and it's actually, even though it's not his fault, it's his fault.
Yeah, it is.
The irony.
Yes.
And the levels of irony in this episode are amazing.
So that is a dramatic irony right there.
There we go. That's the word I was looking for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is very fun.
So what do you want to talk about?
Let's get Cyril out of the way here. We bookended this episode with Cyril. We missed him last episode, so glad to have him back. He has a really poignant moment with his new supervisor where his supervisor is going over his resume and he's like, oh, Morlana. And he's like tearing up about how he's like the corrupt system. Like I got scapegoated. Two men died. A murderer is free. And his supervisor's like, look, I know I'm talking a big game about how important this job is, but literally I just need a warm body. Like, I know you want to get your record formally expunged. We're just going to edit this part out. And it's a really interesting, ironic turn there that the supervisor is like, I'm just going to like corrupt things a teensy bit for you just because otherwise it's too much of a hassle to hire you.
I mean, I think there's another layer of irony there, which is that Karn's former supervisor, the deputy inspector on Morlana One, also wanted to bend the rules and erase things off the record and smooth his own way. And I guess now we're seeing Karn is okay with it when it's finally working in his favor, which is getting him a job, any job, anything to get Edie off of his back.
Anything to live on the other side of Coruscant.
Oh my God. His mom is just saying everything we're thinking, and I didn't realize how mean it was until she said it out loud.
Mean. She's so mean.
He's sitting there in his suit, and she's like, really? That suit? And he's like, it's a brown suit, mom. And she's like, you know what that suit says to me about you? It tells me everything I need to know. You're desperate. You're weak. You're insecure. You have no moral fortitude. You eat space loops for breakfast. And I'm like, Edie, he's dead. He's dead. Lay off. You killed him.
So that's the Cyril loop. It's interesting that we're still following him. I'm intrigued.
I mean, here's the bad thing about the Cyril plot. Is it fun to watch him squirm? Yeah. But now he's got this dead-end job and a lot of time on his hands for revenge.
Maybe.
So now we've got a bunch of people. We've got Karn sitting in his cubicle with time to look for Cassian. We have Vel has been ordered to look for Cassian.
Mm-hmm.
And Deirdre Miro's job is now to investigate Ferrix, where she's probably going to find Cassian.
Well, no, because he's disappeared off the grid because Keefe Grigo is in jail for 6 years.
But I bet they've got a headshot.
Yeah, but how many, like, no one has color monitors in Star Wars.
That's so true.
Yeah.
It's blue or black, baby.
Yeah. And even then, like, I don't know. I feel like facial recognition software doesn't work as well with aliens or shapeshifters or what have you.
Unless you've got an entire data clerk who is afraid of you at your fingertips.
That's true. That's true.
Anyway, I'm nervous because
Cyril exists.
Because Cyril exists and Deirdre exists and Vel exists and Cassian is not being as careful as he could be.
So let's talk about Cassian then, because
yes, please.
He doesn't get terribly much in this arc. Sort of the second half of the episode's about him.
He doesn't get a lot, but he got enough to send me down the rabbit hole.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk about the hero's journey?
Sure.
I desperately want to, so I hope you will come along on the ride with me.
I recently re-listened to our old episode where we talked about the hero's journey. I don't remember what episode it was.
Was it the Mortis arc?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's great because, you know, that whole conceptual framework was built and deeply inspired the original Star Wars. And so, like, the reverberations of the Star Wars storytelling style continue to carry it. So let's talk about it in Andor.
We actually get a different side of the hero's journey this episode. Well, we get both sides. So I'm referencing right now the 1949 book by Joseph Campbell, The Hero with a Thousand Faces.
Mm-hmm.
It is colloquially known as the book that describes the hero's journey. It's all over Star Wars because George Lucas was so deeply inspired by this idea. And we get some different facets of it. So what happens in the hero's journey, we're basically going through the first two steps. The hero is going about their day-to-day business, and then they hear a call to action, and they can either accept the call or reject the call. So Cassian, with the Aldani heist, has accidentally given a whole bunch of people a call to action, and now they're hearing it, and they're accepting it.
That's what Marva says. She says, it's overdue, it's probably doomed, and I'm too old, and I don't care.
If there are heroes brave enough to take on an Imperial garrison, I'm brave enough to stick it out here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cassian, on the other hand, inadvertently created a call to action, and now he's refusing it, right? So he hears that there is a call to do something. Rise up against the Empire. And he's like, no, I'm not going to do that. Marva, I'm leaving you here. I'm going to a beach planet. I want to forget about the Empire. I want to pretend it doesn't exist. But the thing about the call is that it gets harder and harder to ignore every time you refuse it.
Mm-hmm.
So refusing the call can kind of go two ways. You can hesitate and then accept the call. or you refuse it entirely. And what I'm seeing Cassian doing here is refusing the call entirely. Mm-hmm. And Joseph Campbell says that when you refuse it, you go through the exit threshold. That's capital E, capital T, exit threshold. You enter a shadow journey.
Oh.
Capital S, capital J. The shadow journey is the anti-hero's journey. You refused to give up your own self-interests. You refused to give up the way things are.
You go to a beach planet.
You go to a beach planet. You pretend that you can't hear the call at all. So you refuse to give up your present state, your comfortable life, your status quo. You sabotage the potential future that you could have mm-hmm. at expense of saving your present. And what Joseph Campbell says is that realizing that you've done that to yourself is painful. So you build up walls of delusion and rationalization to pretend like you didn't do it. What he says is we build a protective labyrinth of rationalizations, excuses, and delusions. Eventually, however, the wall we build to keep painful reminders out becomes a prison that keeps us in. And then our world contracts. Mm-hmm. So let's walk through what Cassian did. Mm-hmm. He ran away. He rationalized that what he was doing was fine because this isn't – like he did what he needed to do and no one asked more of him. So he is allowed to just spend his money on the beach and do whatever he wants. And then the walls that he built around himself contract so hard that they become a jail cell.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah. Ironically. Yeah. Wow.
He drank a lot of booze. He took a lot of pills. He tried to forget. And now the walls that were trying to protect him are now imprisoning him.
Gosh. Yeah. Yeah. Meanwhile, Marva is heeding that call.
Yeah. And she's about to go do something cool for the Empire. So all is not lost for Cassian. I don't know what happens, but if we're purely going by the hero's journey, Cassian will have one more chance, right?
Five more episodes.
The way out of the shadow journey is if your imprisonment, if your walls shift your perspective enough that you become open mm-hmm. to carrying on with the journey. So if you take that insight and you become open to the journey ahead. So, I mean, I guess we're going to see if Cassian gets another chance mm-hmm. and if he takes it.
Interesting.
Isn't it? Isn't the hero's journey so cool? I was thinking about this because I'm beta reading my best friend's book mm-hmm. and she structures it around the hero's journey. So it's top of mind for me right now.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah.
I think that's really interesting about Cassian and this hero's journey because like it is his hero's journey, right? Like he is the one who is the hero of the story. And it's interesting that by him declining the call, we are getting more examples of other people having their journeys. We get to see like smaller examples. I don't think anyone else is quite having like a massive hero's journey as far as, you know, doing something they don't want to do. Like, we don't really learn many other people's backstories. Like, Val is up to whatever. Cyril's up to whatever. Deidre, don't know much about her backstory. We know enough to know that she is, like, this antagonist. It really speaks to the tight storytelling of this story that it has a clearly defined hero. The hero doesn't actually need a lot of lines to be a hero.
Or to have a lot going on to show the complexities of his journey, because he's not a classic hero.
You know, so much of this, I kind of hold this up as like an icon for good storytelling. One of my very, very favorite, most definitive works of this is the pinnacle of science fiction is this story by Isaac Asimov, a short story, and it's about a robot following the three laws on Mercury, and there's like a situation, the robot has to go rescue someone and it just keeps going in circles. Mm. And they're like calling a mechanic to say, what's wrong with the robot? And the mechanic says, well, the robot's like following this equation and it's just prioritizing danger to others, danger to itself. And if it can rescue someone in that order, and basically like we need to change something at this end because the robot's just following what it needs to do.
Ooh.
And what I love about that, and I love about like the Foundation series, is that you could put this on in the Globe Theater in 1580. you could have these characters just saying their lines. Like the action matters so much less. This whole thing could be done on a high school stage. And Andor, mostly also. And I love that because it shows like the true pinnacle of storytelling, that it is like a theater and these different actors coming into play, telling the backstory of someone. Like, we don't need to know the backstories of all the characters, but we know enough for them to be characters, and that amps up someone else. We just have just enough to make the story of Andor deeply compelling on all levels.
One of my favorite things about extraordinarily well-written stuff, whether it's a sci-fi novel or this screenplay for Andor, is that it does the burlesque tease, mm-hmm. where it's like pulling back the sleeve just enough to give you exactly what you wanted. And in this case, what we needed to move forward. But even Marva's lines are incredible. I mean, we've gotten so little of Marva, but we know enough to realize that what she's doing is absolutely heroic.
What I love about Marva so much, and we touched on this a little bit in the earlier episodes, and I'd forgotten about it because, like, the dialogue in this is so sparse. It's so spare. There's nothing extraneous in the dialogue. And what it comes down to is it's the other people on Ferrix. The fact that when they see Cassian, they're like, how's your mother? And they're not like they're saying that in terms of respect.
How's your mother? Parentheses, non-derogatory.
Yeah, exactly.
Respectful.
Word to your mother. And the way that comes across is all of a sudden, without anything really before this scene, Marva is already a hero of the people of Ferrix in one way or the other.
I hadn't thought about that. She is the respected elder.
She is the respected elder.
And when she rises up in support of the rebellion, maybe people will follow her.
Yeah.
I just got goosebumps from my scalp to my toes.
And that setup is basically from Brassos's like six lines.
Yeah, we came by. You need to tell Marva to turn the heat on because we're worried about her.
Yes, and from talking with Bix and Spaced Him and the dude at the port and Jack Three Daws. Like, there's three Jack Daws. There's like everyone knows Marva, and I think that's really, really cool.
I want to revise or like maybe add on to what you said, which is that Cassian is the hero of his story. It's easy to see his hero's journey. I think we're now seeing Marva's hero's journey. I think there's enough there for us to recognize that she heard the call, accepted the call, and now she is going to go off on her adventure. And I say adventure because that's what Joseph Campbell calls it. It is an adventure. It's going to be harrowing. Right.
Did you notice the last thing she picked up as Cassian's leaving her house?
She was watering her plants, right?
No, she picked up a gun.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh.
She picked up a blaster and is like, I am tired of wandering around this house waiting to die. Yeah. I'm going to go cause a ruckus.
I love that because she's in that scene watering her plants, which is like life, and then picks up the gun, which is like business. I don't want to move on from Marva without talking about my favorite piece of dialogue between her and Cassian. So she says, there is work that we'll need doing. And Cassian's like, yeah, what work? And she's like, whatever it takes. And he's like, you can't beat them, Marva. And then she says, not if I run away. I'm just thinking about like the number of times I've said to myself, you can't do that, Anna. Like, you're not, whatever. You're not going to be able to do that. It's not possible. And what if I said, not if I run away? Like, what if we showed up in our lives like that?
Yeah. She also has a line that's meaningful to me when she says the empire is everywhere. They've taken over the old hotel. They've got a garrison here. And Cassian says, well, then let's go someplace the empire isn't. And she says, they're everywhere we can go, but they're not in my own head.
They can't find me there.
They can't find me there, and they can't alter the way I feel. They can't change the reality inside my own head. And that's what Nemec was saying about, like, the objective reality of truth.
That's really cool. There are warrior philosophers everywhere in this show.
Yeah, there are. And some of them, you know, walk with a cane and yell at their little B2 droid. And some of them died on the operating table. And some of them haven't figured out who they are yet.
Ooh, rebels all around us. Mm-hmm.
So we've been talking a lot about the A plot and the S plot. I think there's a little bit more to talk about in the LM plot and the PQRS plot.
What's the PQRS
plot? I'm just running out of alphabet letters here. Let's talk about the authoritarianism.
Ooh, thank you for bringing that up.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot going on with the Empire this episode. I started thinking, and I haven't studied governments in a long time, but here's my hypothesis. I think we are watching, especially in this episode, the Empire move from an authoritarian state to a totalitarian state.
Ooh, what is the difference between those?
There is a difference. I know they sound like synonyms. An authoritarian regime is interesting because it's got all of the hallmarks of a terrible, oppressive government, right? But it still allows for social and economic institutions to be not under governmental control. And it kind of relies on like passive mass acceptance rather than people actively popularly supporting it.
Okay, so like a plutocracy is an authoritarian state of government because the plutarchs have their own separate power structures from the government.
Yeah, so in an authoritarian state, you can either have one dear leader or mm-hmm. you can have an elite group at the top, right? Totalitarianism is different because it means that any power structure that is not part of the government is sucked into the government mm-hmm. and the government takes it over. So let me just read you some great stuff about totalitarianism states. They are based on subordination of the individual to the state and strict control of all aspects of the life and productive capacity of the nation, especially by coercive measures like censorship, like terrorism. Unlike autocracies, so an authoritarian regime, which seek only to gain absolute political power and outlaw opposition, totalitarian states not only seek to gain absolute political power and outlaw opposition, they seek to dominate every aspect of everyone's life as a prelude to world domination.
So I definitely see that in multiple instances. One of them is what Marva is talking about how the Empire can't be in her own mind. And that is the difference between an authoritarian state and a totalitarian state. The other one is the specific example twice of Preox Morlana being rolled up into the Empire and Ferrix having a garrison rolled over. And also Cinta gets one in this episode because as she's digging up her speeder bike to ride down a scree field in a fantastic scene, a Star Destroyer is vibrating violently overhead, wrecking the entire city, like the entire planet of Aldani. I mean, it's not doing anything, but it's just patrolling mm-hmm. within a close distance of the planet.
Yeah, so let's think about what the Empire tried to do this episode. Any planet harboring rebel activity will be taxed 5 times what was stolen from Aldani. So there is no longer tolerance for any group that is not deferring to the Empire. Mm-hmm. The ISB gets to hand wave anything even related to search and seizure laws, no Fourth Amendments are to be had the galaxy
they have basically
ever again.
Unlimited power. And Yularen says, I spoke with the Emperor last night, and the ISB will be taking the lead on this.
So a political structure, a political group that used to be ostensibly at least a little bit free of the Emperor's influence is now just a tool mm-hmm. of Palpatine mm-hmm. to reach out across the galaxy and do whatever he wants them to do. And then galaxy-wide, any behavior that seems like it could be in any way criminal or anti-imperial means you are marched into jail and you will probably never leave. Yep. So there is no longer tolerance for individuals to be individuals. They are now tools of the state.
Yep.
That's totalitarianism.
Sure is.
And isn't it interesting to watch that shift happen in real time?
Yeah.
Crazy.
So that segues nicely into what I wanted to talk about and did my research on, which is the concept of accelerationism.
Ooh.
Which I think is what Luthen is all about.
Tell me all about it.
So in order to break a system, you have to move it too fast. And like, as Nemec said, you know, 40 atrocities per day, you can keep ratcheting. As Luthen said, they're choking us and we need to know how tight things are. People need to have their memories jogged of how different things used to be. And so in order to do that, there exists a school of radical thought, which is push the system in the direction it's going too fast. Try to jog a response. And this has been co-opted by Nazis in our world. The concept only exists, it was invented in 2010, but it's been co-opted by modern Nazi groups.
Yeah, yeah. Give me some like examples.
So the left-wing examples are to really dive into like the legalistic interpretation of who is a person who has voting rights. Because one can look back 100 years, 200 years, and look back to like, why is this person not allowed to vote? And the answer is like, oh, because they're a woman. Oh, because they're a person of color. I'm like, all right, let's define what a person of color means in this context. Like, I'm going to make you show your work as opposed to just institutionalizing cultural mores and pushing that line over and over and over again to really puncture things. And it happens not just at like this political legal level. It also happens at like a societal level.
And a cultural level too.
And a cultural level. And I think that there's a lot of hope in it. Being a sober person, I read a lot of literature about sobriety. And a lot of it in like the 1930s is about how it's something you have to keep hidden, that it's this like disgusting disease that'll spread and that like you can't even share with it. And like you can only find a community of like-minded people to help you. And now it's actually like an industry, you know? And the same thing with AIDS. During the AIDS epidemic, people thought you could get AIDS by touching other people. And then Princess Diana went and shook the hand of someone who had AIDS and was like, check it out. I didn't get AIDS from a handshake because it's a bloodborne illness. And everyone knew this. But it takes a critical amount of compassion to move the laws, to move the zeitgeist of the land in one direction or the other.
And bravery,
yes. And it, you know, it's the moment of Emperor Has No Clothes, of just being like, we've been lying for so long, or we've institutionalized so many behaviors for so long that we need to deinstitutionalize those and push them to a logical conclusion. Now, the Nazi right-wing, alt-right, whatever, all same, side of it is to increase terror in order to break democratic institutions. Because the slide towards totalitarianism and Earth Prime here is continuing and has been for a while. The peak of democracy was the late 90s, early 2000s. We've gone downhill since in terms of democratic institutions and independent judiciaries, things like that, all across the globe. And there are a few success stories, and many of them do involve a push towards a crackdown. And the thing is, when you create a situation, and your situation could be the Aldani heist, or it could be however one wishes to capitalize on a terrorist attack, you're left with this response of, do we as a government shift to the right and crack things down and put in place curfews and levy fines? Or do we exhibit like, hey, we need to have a ceasefire? Do we need to like calm things down?
It's fundamentally, it's conservatism versus liberalism. It's, do we respond to crisis by retreating inwards and cracking down conservatism, or liberalism by opening up and expanding a doctrine of compassion and rightfulness?
And what happens is that if you push this conservatism far enough, you can just fundamentally break institutions for a long time or permanently. Looking back on like the wake of 9/11 in America, there were many things which were deeply broken for a long time in terms of like secret black budgets for the government just exploded and continued to explode. In the 2000 election, Bush versus Gore, Al Gore was talking about how Social Security is self-funding, has no problems. It is owed $25 billion by the military that the military borrowed from it. And if it needs to be in a lockbox so that it can't have its money withdrawn from underneath it.
100%.
And people are like, that is liberal nonsense. Get out of here.
Oh, my God.
And now it's being used as a weapon against a functioning government. So we've moved in this crazy direction because it's been slow. And the problem with acceleration, as Luthen sees it, and I think Mon Mothma sees this as well, is that like if you go too slow, you've just made things worse for a long time. Mm-hmm. And if you go, but if you go fast enough, you might be able to run this thing off the rails and you might actually be able to cause a violent revolution. Mm-hmm. And generally, that is not what people are looking for. Even like hardcore Trotskyists are like, we don't need like permanent, like the permanent world revolution of Trotskyism is inside your head. You know, it's like, I need to be continually reevaluating ideals. It's not taking a rifle to your neighbor because otherwise you have no world. And so this idea of accelerationism, as Luthen did it in this episode, of like, start this fire, get people going, increase unrest, cause problems, spread the empire thin, I think is really valuable. But it's an interesting and scary topic. And I think I empathize with Mon Mothma in that of like, surely there's a way out of this that is more peaceful, that doesn't involve an increase in suffering. And Luthen's like, I'm just changing the timetable for suffering. I'm jumping us ahead, maybe only like 3 weeks, maybe 6 months,
maybe three years.
But all I'm doing is changing the timetable.
Yeah.
And Luthen has the faith of a zealot that the empire is an unstable equilibrium. It will fall. It will fall after a certain amount of time. And he assumes that that time is when Palpatine dies. And so speed it up. Speed it up. Get to the end, boss. Let's make it happen. We're as ready as we are ever going to be. We are not getting stronger. We need to grow or die.
It's very much a utilitarianism point of view, right? He's like, the ends justify the means.
Yeah.
If people are suffering already, they might as well suffer the amount that they would have suffered just in a shorter time frame.
May as well suffer for something.
And may as well suffer for something. I think with Nemec gone, Luthen is the purest ideological rebel zealot we've seen and we're seeing.
I think it's Kleia.
You think it's Kleia?
Kleia's hard.
Dude, she's horrifying.
Kleia's hard.
Especially now that I'm putting together Little Red Riding Hood Rebel Lady as Kleia with Kleia in the art gallery.
So this is my second watch through of Andor. I watched it about a year ago, I guess, and enjoyed the hell out of it. I think it was in early spring, so like 6 months ago. And this time around, I'm like, I think Kleia might actually be in charge.
Wow. Well, she's definitely subverting Luthen's authority, or maybe she has authority over Luthen because she goes out and she's like, listen, I know Luthen really likes this Andor character, but you got to kill him.
Exactly. And is she doing that because she needs to protect Luthen because Luthen's the face and he's the one who like is cultivating contacts with Mon Mothma or something? But she's also like, there's no authority divide between them. Like as Mon Mothma's leaving, Kleia's like, I hope she's worth it. Which is something that you don't say to like a supervisor.
Right? So let's talk. I want to very briefly touch on Mon Mothma, because is she worth it? We got a lot of insight into her character this episode, and there's kind of two different things going on with her. You know, one of them is her wanting to avoid suffering, which is not very rebel of her. I mean, it's a different flavor of rebel. But her other thing is when she's walking around with Tay and she has that fascinating line, "I learned from the Emperor, if you see the stone in my hand, you miss the knife at your throat."
Yes.
So I'm like, who is Mon Mothma really?
Who is she really? I think in this case, she knows exactly who she is. She is a vocal supporter of the squishy stuff. She's known to be a soft-hearted liberal politician in the Empire.
In the vein of Padme, in the vein of Ryo-Chuchi, just 100% earnest about her ideals, and there's nothing going on beneath the surface.
And if there was, it would be so weak and limp-wristed it couldn't do anything.
Exactly.
And also, she is absolutely burning through generations of family wealth to blow crap up.
I love that she's weaponizing everything at her disposal. She's weaponizing her beauty, her money, her charm, her power, her reputation. Mm-hmm. I think she's clever and cunning in a way that the Padmes and Chuchis we've seen, and even the Satines, and she's ruthless in a way that our female leaders have not been so far in Star Wars.
They haven't had to be up until now, and I think that's why she's alive.
And she's not afraid for people to not see who she really is. She's not afraid to be underestimated.
Yeah.
And that's also really different from what we've seen. We've so often in Star Wars seen women who had to be, who were striving to be taken at face value. Mm-hmm. And just respected for who they are. And Mothma's like, I don't care if you respect me. I'm respectable in and of myself. Yeah. You don't need to know that for me to be worth it.
And you don't have to know one way or the other. It's none of your business.
Yeah. She's a new kind of politician for Star Wars.
Definitely. This whole episode treads new ground in a bunch of directions. First of all, there's more drugs and sex in this episode than just about any previous one, because Cassian's sitting there in the shower. His hookup from last night's like, go to the store and buy drugs. And he's like counting his money and hiding it above the shower. Also Namek's manifesto and his father's gun.
That is a lot of faith in his hookup to not go cleaning the rafters. I don't know. She doesn't seem like a cleaning house kind of gal. She
doesn't. We also see this beauty in age. So often in media, 19-year-olds with strong jawlines and clear skin are the rebels. And in reality, the rebellion takes hold on the people who are like old enough to have some means and something to live for. That's a truly inspirational figure. Mm. That's a figure who can make things happen. The rebel who is on the recruiting poster is cannon fodder. The rebel who is making the recruiting poster is your Luthans and your Marvas. Mm. And I think that this shows that very well, because we do get to see Mon Mothma, mother of a teenager, Luthan, owner of a shop with gray fake hair, and Marva, who, you know, pretty much homebound, who's approaching the sunset of her life, sitting there saying, now's the time to rise up.
There are all different ways to be a rebel.
Yes, wow. And different ages to be a rebel. And I think that bringing to light the ages of rebellion is a really valuable thing in this.
I love that.
Because we also see it in the Rebels TV show that there's kids and adults, but, you know, the oldest person in that family is, what, 27?
Sometimes you do need your strong fist of teenagers and moms and dads to like do your rebel activity. And then you also need your Marvas and your Luthans to be like the wise elders guiding the entire thing. Mm-hmm. That's cool.
I guess the more I think about it, Zeb's probably old and Chopper's probably old. But other than that, yes.
Are they old in body and young in mind? Because that's how I think of them.
Yeah, sure.
It's about time for us to crown our bae for this episode. Are you ready?
Not really, but let's do it anyway.
Okay, it's time for Baywatch.
All right, we have a fine cast of characters who were rising to the call today. Which one rises to the call of Baywatch?
Boy, we got an all-star cast. I thought long and hard about it, and I'm going to shock you, Sam. Mm-hmm. I'm picking Deirdre Mero.
Is this her first appearance?
On Baywatch? Yeah.
Wow, good for her.
Hundo P, good for her. Here's why. I was straight up going to pick Mon Mothma. Mm-hmm. And then I realized that between Mon and Deirdre, we're getting these mirror images of how a woman can be successful in Star Wars. Mm-hmm. And I have to pick Mero. Because Mon, she lets herself be thought of as less than, so she can work behind the scenes. And she's really only putting herself at risk with one person. But Mero is shining as bright as she can in a room full of men who don't like her and don't respect her and don't want her to succeed. And yet she's proving herself in the eyes of all of them. Mm-hmm. And like the scene with Mero and Blevin filled my cup, watered my crops, just had my bank account bursting. Like she is one woman in a room of men and she was freaking impeccable.
Yeah, she was.
She was so good. She got 5 stars from her scary boss.
Who then said, watch your back.
And if someone is saying, watch your back after you own the room, like you're doing it right.
Oh, I don't want to play that game. But yeah.
It's amazing to see her do it. Mm-hmm. And like, again, with me being like, yes, Deirdre, 5 stars only. Wait, stop being so good at your job. Like, again with that. But I just, she was so, so, so admirable and impressive. And she had the receipts and the data and just like she shone. Mm-hmm. She was so cool. I want to be more like Deirdre Mero. I'm an Edie in a world where I want to be a Mero.
Wow. Out of all the women to be in this episode, including like Bix and the
Marva,
the one night from Kessin's. Yeah. You're picking those two.
Maybe I don't believe in myself as much as I could. Mm. Anyway, who did you pick?
I'm going to go with Luthen.
Yeah.
And here's why. It was a very, very tough call. Love the work Clea did. And that is part of what rises Luthen up is because they're really a team that works well together.
Dynamic duo.
Love the work that Mon Mothma did. Mm-hmm. And that also elevates Luthen. And honestly, I love the work that Andor and Marva did. But Luthen gets it because he is sitting there. He's putting on his game face and he's taking it off as he turns the room. He's sitting there and he is cultivating this relationship with Mon Mothma. And not only is that like what a spy does is you like cultivate an asset and you grow an asset and you activate the asset and you get stuff out of him. And it doesn't really depend what. You just like form a file folder of like, these are my guns for hire. These are my senators. These are my like bankers. These are my gamblers. These are my drivers. These are my getaway men.
Here's my Andors.
Yes. Yeah. And here's the wild cards. And you have like files and files of these people. And Luthen is sitting there and he's having this conversation with Mon Mothma. And she is distinctly unhappy with the resolution. And he's like, yeah, that's not how this is going to play out. And she walks away and he has full faith that she's going to do the right thing no matter what. Mm. And if she doesn't, he has contingencies in place.
Luthen appears to be a really remarkable judge of character.
More than that, he is... We talked about this back in like the Night Sisters arc, that there's sort of a very high table that a few people are playing the game at.
Yeah.
And then there's like the lower table, which is your Vaders, your Kiras, your Mauls, people who like your Jabbas, people who run big enterprises.
Sectors. Yeah.
Who have thousands of people at their command. But to get to the highest of high tables, like Palpatine, like Mother Talzin, you have to be playing those people. You don't need 1,000 soldiers when one of your soldiers controls 10,000 Star Destroyers. Mm. Luthen is playing at that high table and no one knows he's there.
What?
Luthen is controlling senators in a way that Palpatine wishes he could.
Wow.
And he can't do it in bulk, and he doesn't have Star Destroyers, but he has the ability to tell someone what they're going to do, and they may not like it, and they do it. And that person is a very respectable senator.
Oh my gosh.
And his relationship with Kleia, they're capable of handling this massive picture and loose end close it. Easy breezy.
And they make it look so good.
They do. They're so stylish. And the level of like information exchange between them is probably such that they're basically just running two separate rebellions and don't know anything about it. Kleia listens in on Luthen's conversations, but mostly probably to make sure she's not bugged.
Oh my God, I just realized they're literally styling and profiling.
All right, we're done here.
I'm sorry. Did I ruin your Baywatch?
Yes.
Oh, no.
That's very Edie of you.
I'll make it up for you next week.
you're at an Edie. I need you at a Deidre.
On that note, I am chagrined. What are we watching next week?
We are watching Andor Season 1, Episode 8, Narkeena 5.
Huh. That sounds like a speeder.
Sure does.
Did I guess that right?
No.
Oh, man. I guess we'll find out next week.
We sure will.
In the meantime, if you love Growing Up Skywalker, you should rate us 5 stars if you have the opportunity on your podcast platform of choice. It also really helps with our discoverability if you will write us just a quick review about what you like about us. It just really helps us to get into the earbuds of more Star Wars fans.
Speaking of Star Wars fans, special thank you to our newest Patreon, Camilla, who not only informed us that we had accidentally uploaded the wrong episode last week, but also became our newest Patreon this week.
Yeah, thanks, Camilla. You can also find us on social media. We are on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and sometimes we're on Twitter.
We're always on Twitter unless they start making me pay for it, because I'm not paying for Twitter.
No, yeah, fair.
They're like, it's $1 a year. I'm like, it's the principle of the thing. If I pay for something, I don't want ads, you
know? That sounds more like a totalitarian state than what we are currently in. So I would be wary if Twitter starts to charge us. And this is also a wonderful time to become one of our monthly patrons. For as little as $3 a month, you can get access to our entire backlog of bonus audio content and everything we record moving forward.
So thanks for all of our patrons. Thanks to all of our listeners. Join us for Narkeena 5 and send this episode to someone who is tired of waiting around, worried that nothing's going to matter, but too old to do anything other than bring the power to the people.
Power to the people.
There we go. All right. And we'll see you next week.
Talk to you next Tuesday.
Bye-bye.